From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina's premier higher education watchdog has changed its name. You'll learn why the new name honors former two-term Republican Governor Jim Martin. Some state lawmakers want to take an in-depth look at the way taxpayers fund the state's public schools. You'll hear details of a new task force it's designed to address that very topic. Free speech is under attack on college campuses across the country, including North Carolina, but the news about official campus speech codes is pretty good. You'll learn why. Plus, we'll explain how North Carolina has seen benefits already from a recent reform. It's designed to help scrap old and unnecessary rules from the state's rule books. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
It is called the Public Utilities Regulatory Policies Act, and it's a federal law that forces public utilities to buy power from electric power plants that are fueled by renewable energy. Now, this law is quite complex, but one of its outcomes is really pretty simple. North Carolinians are paying more for power when cheaper sources are actually available. Carolina Journal's Dan Way, who is an associate editor for the newspaper, has been following this story. He joins me now. Dan, welcome.
Thank you.
Why did you get interested in this Federal Regulatory Act, which is commonly known as PURPA?
Well, this is among the items that I cover under my regulatory coverage for the Carolina Journal. And certainly it's a topic of great interest in the public. And they also had a committee meeting at the House Energy Committee where this was being discussed. So it was right up my alley.
So at this legislative committee meeting, what did they talk about? Why was it on the agenda?
Well, it was really kind of a primer for a lot of the legislators. This is a horribly complex series of regulations that involve renewable energy.
The name alone is complex for some of us.
It is. So they call it PURPA for short.
Right.
And they were getting basically educated and informed on how this federal law affects state public policy. This PURPA law gives states a wide degree of latitude in how they can implement it. And what we're finding out is that North Carolina has very generous benefits for renewable companies under this law. They don't have to be this generous.
In fact, some Duke Energy officials were actually at this legislative committee meeting, and they were talking about this, how generous this is. Explain to us what the import of that testimony was.
Well, at the very basic level, what happens with these generous subsidies and contracts and things that are available under the PURPA law, the belief is that this costs the ratepayers more money in their monthly bills.
Ratepayers being you and me. People who pay the
Those
electric
of us
bills.
Who pay the electric bills.
Okay. So that is the kind of the bottom line notion here, that because of, in part at least, this federal regulation and North Carolina being required to comply with that through public utility companies, that they end up buying renewable energy sources that cost more and then pass that cost on to us?
Right. Costs always get passed on to the consumer,
That's right.
as we know. So there are a number of ways that happens. One thing that Duke pointed out is that we have a 15-year contract under the PURPA law here that's guaranteed fixed-term rates for the renewable companies. Now, these rates are only available to this is what they call a standard contract, and those rates only go to a facility that produces 5 megawatts or less. So anything between 5 megawatts and 80, those are negotiated contracts, but they have to give a guaranteed rate to those smaller generating plants.
So North Carolina then actually decides what the rate is going to be to purchase this renewable energy?
Yeah, those are all pretty much set in statute. So that's one of the things that Duke says, maybe it's time now we look at this. You know, this PURPA law first went into effect in 1978 in the Jimmy Carter administration. at the height of the oil embargo and a lot of concerns about what is our future energy situation going to look like. And so one of the things that the Carter administration did was try to look at alternative sources of energy so we could be more energy independent.
So Duke officials are at this hearing and they're talking about this. What is their interest in this? Why did they come to testify?
Well, there are a number of reasons why they're interested in this. One, of course, being the cost. They're the ones who have to pass those costs to the consumers.
So they were actually looking out for their customers.
Well, that's what they're saying. You know, the renewable folks would say that they're looking out for their own best interests.
And therein lies the rub into this controversy. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, obviously, everyone has a stake in the game. And so the renewable companies say, well, you know, we need these things to be on a level playing field with you, the big monopolistic energy giants. The energy companies say, well, there's a lot of problems with this, you know, number one being mandated to do anything. There are some remedies that they would like to see done. They want to reduce that 5-megawatt guaranteed fixed contract to 1 megawatt. They would like to see things more free market based, like competitive bidding, instead of having to give what's called an avoided cost rate to these renewable plants. Avoided cost is what the it's a complicated formula, but basically it says that these utilities have to pay a certain amount of money to equal what they would have paid if they had to build that plant that the renewable companies did, or if they had to purchase that energy that they need elsewhere. So what the utilities are saying is that if we didn't have to do that avoided cost, if we bid these out on the market, we would get a more accurate market-based price than some mandated policy.
Now, I think this is a good example, Dan, of how, first of all, your excellent reporting on this, and it's all available at carolinajournal.com. But it's obviously a complex story, a complex regulation. But when you kind of try to push aside all of the nuts and bolts of this, at least one state legislator looked at this, and this was part of your story, and said, you know, this just doesn't seem right. We should be doing something about this. Tell us what his concern was.
Yeah, Jeff Collins, who represents Nash County, is the chairman of the Energy Committee, and he wasn't the only one. There's a lot of questions being raised now as more and more of this comes to light. You know, these laws have been entrenched for a long time now, and so some of the manifestations of these are just starting to percolate through the legislature, and there's a lot of questions being raised.
And this all relates to renewable energy and the push, not only in North Carolina, but around the country to take a better look at developing like solar and wind and things like that.
Yeah, and what Duke and others are saying is that because of these mandates, sometimes they're actually having to purchase electricity from these renewable generating plants that they don't even need. And under the PURPA law, they don't have any control over that. They can't pull a lever or push a switch at any given time and say, okay, we don't need you now. Now we're going to ramp you up. And that's another one of the reasons why they think if they would go to a more competitive bidding kind of a process, they could get what's called the dispatchability rights, where they can control the flow of that electricity. So they're, you know, the plants, the nuclear plants or the gas plants that actually cost less could be used more, and they would only add these other systems in as they needed.
Let me make sure I understand this. So the utilities are required to buy a certain amount of their power as renewable sources, solar and wind and things like that. And you're saying that sometimes they say they actually have to buy power that they really don't need in order to serve their customers. So add all of this together, Dan, and it sounds to me like when I get my bill in the mail, it could be lower.
Well, and that's what the critics would say. And, you know, you might need an army of forensic accountants to figure out how all this works.
Right.
And that's part of what the legislators are trying to do, because there's all kinds of riders and other incentives and programs in there that Duke will tell you that they all interplay. But you can't sit down and look at your bill and ferret that out, because some of these things are hidden in all these other areas.
What is the next step in this, Dan?
Well, I think they're going to continue to look at this, and some folks are pushing to maybe look at doing some of the reforms that Duke is advocating. And, of course, the renewable industry will probably continue to fight it. So,
and other states are actually doing some reforms on this because they are dealing with the same thing.
Idaho reduced their contract lengths from 20 to 2 years, and they said what they found is they do get a better rate for their customers.
Anne White, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The challenges linked to higher education in North Carolina are changing. The state's premier higher education watchdog is changing as well. Joining us to discuss the changes, two people closely connected to the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. One of them is the center's president, Jenna Robinson. The other, the center's namesake, the Honorable James G. Martin, former governor of North Carolina. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Hi, Mitch.
So first of all, I want to start with Governor Martin. This is a group that for years was known as the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy. Now it's the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. Why was that something that you felt comfortable and interested in being involved in, having your name connected with this group?
You think it should have been scary to even think about? No, it's quite an honor, of course, and for my colleagues on the board to have come up with that name. In my absence, I was absent from those meetings when that was being discussed, and I wanted them to discuss it frankly and raise whatever concerns they had outside of my, you know, so I wouldn't be offended and hurt, my feelings hurt. But it's quite an honor, particularly because I had great admiration for Joy and John Pope, and they were people that I got to know when I first was working to come to Raleigh as governor. And they were good supporters, and I've admired the work that they've done, in particular the various foundations and think tanks that he has created, and in particular serving on the board of the Pope Center made it all the more meaningful to me. And, of course, they didn't require that I had to die first to name it.
What about
that was
the,
good.
What about
but the most important thing, of course, is the academic renewal part of it. That shows where we're going.
Yeah, and what is it about the work that the center, now the Martin Center, has done that made you say, yes, I can tie my name to this group? This makes sense to me.
Well, I've been following it closely as a board member and before that, as in reading the magazines, the articles, meeting some of the people who are doing the work. Sometimes I might even have a disagreement on some particular point. You know, if we all thought the same way on everything, they'd only need one of us to make all the decisions. But it's been very creative and very effective, and now with the Board of Governors paying attention to it, I think it's going to be very helpful to the state.
So this is a group that for years operated under a different name. Now it is the Martin Center, the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. Jenna, as the president of that center, does this open up some opportunities for new ways of thinking or acting on issues related to higher education?
I think the one thing that it has done immediately that's going to be helpful is there won't be any more confusion anymore about us being the foundation or the center. We are clearly the Martin Center. We work exclusively on higher education issues. And for a very long time, There's been existing confusion about which is the foundation, which is the center, who does what. And I think clearing up that confusion is going to be immensely helpful. And we've already seen it in the way that people are treating us, realizing this is a higher education think tank. This is their exclusive work that they do. And so that's been wonderful. Also, of course, Governor Martin has been immensely effective as a governor. He is respected in the academic community and by the government, by other leaders, by newspapers, by pundits. And so I think having his name attached to our work will lend it a certain something.
Quite a bit of credibility from his background.
Absolutely.
What are some of the main things?
We'll hope for that in any case.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What are some of the main things that the Martin Center is going to be focusing on moving forward now?
Moving forward, some of the things that are going to be most important to me this year, the first one is free speech. Of course, that has always been very important to us, but we're seeing some new opportunities to pursue protections for students regarding free speech. It's something that I know the Board of Governors is very interested in. The public is very interested. I think there's been a lot of publicity regarding attacks on free speech, students being arrested for passing out constitutions, other attacks on free speech. And so I think all of that publicity and kind of the mounting attention that it has gotten means that protection for free speech will be an issue that we can get some traction on this year. As always, I'm interested in transparency, and I'm hoping we can get more information in the hands of students to help them make better decisions going forward. I think that's especially important given the amount of debt that students are taking on. And like free speech, I think it has gotten a lot of attention. It makes it ripe for reform.
That is the voice of Jenna Robinson. She is the president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. You are also hearing from the namesake of that center, the former North Carolina governor, the Honorable James G. Martin. And for those who don't know, in addition to your political career, you had a background in higher education. You were a longtime professor at Davidson College. When you
taught chemistry there for 12 years, that's right.
When you
before
look,
my head was turned,
before
my
lust
for power in my heart.
Would you look at where things stood in the world of academics at that time and where things stand now? Are the things that rise to the forefront that make you say, we really need to make some changes or to reassert the importance of some of these basic principles that were around when I was teaching?
Well, Jenna touched on one of the changes that's been very, very profound and very troubling. But even back in my day, you go back 50 years, there was the issue of academic freedom. Then it was particularly oriented toward protecting the rights of faculty members who had left-wing views because colleges were being attacked by donors who didn't want to hear from someone who was defending the Soviet Union. And Davidson took the view that as long as they kept that separate from their academic responsibilities, it didn't try to indoctrinate students on their views, that they would be protected in their teaching role, and if they wanted to write to the newspaper, they could. But even then, there was a case where one of my colleagues was shunned as a political science professor by his faculty colleagues because they said he didn't go to a respected academic institution. He got his economics PhD at University of Chicago. His thesis advisor was a fellow named Friedrich von Hayek, who a couple of years after Gene Miller left to go to University of Georgia, von Hayek got the Nobel Prize. So it became respectable after he left. But that should not have happened, and especially at that school. But it goes on all the time now as faculties in departments like economics want to remove anyone who's not a Keynesian. They don't want to have the opposite point of view intrude into their domain. Same thing with political science, sociology, other fields of that sort.
I have to ask, our time is running short, but I want to ask both of you, Jenna first and then Governor Martin, are you excited about the opportunities that are tied to this name change?
Absolutely. I think that the time is ripe for reform in higher education, and I think this name change is coming at exactly the right time for us.
Governor Martin?
Well, I'm more excited about what the institution has been doing and will continue to do to rattle a few cages, to call attention to things that should not be happening in higher education, to set standards that it would be better for our institutions to try to return to renew their academic excellence.
That is the voice of the Honorable James G. Martin, former governor of North Carolina and the namesake of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. You also heard from that center's president, Jenna Robinson. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Glad to be here, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to take an in-depth look at the way public schools are funded. Republican State Representative Craig Horn recently explained a proposal for a new task force.
The purpose of this bill is to establish a joint legislative task force to study various weighted student formula funding models and develop a new funding model for elementary and secondary public schools in North Carolina.
Why is a study so important at this time?
Last fiscal year, the General Assembly appropriated $8.4 billion to K-12 public education, approximately 39% of the entire state budget. We do so based on a system of allocations, or what many of us refer to as silos. Some 37, I believe, silos that we use to allocate K-12 funding. Examples of those silos are classroom teachers, textbooks, administration, children with disabilities, low wealth, small county, and that just names a few. Some allotments are by position, some allotments are dollar, and frankly, that's a concept unto itself that's not fully understood by many legislators. workers, let alone the public.
What would this new task force do? Horn explained.
First, review current allotment system and study in depth various funding models based on a weighted student formula versus an ADM or allotment formula. This committee is to determine a base amount for funds necessary to cover costs of educating a student, to identify the student characteristics eligible for weighted funding, to determine the amount that base funds are to be adjusted based on those student characteristics, and to actually make a decision on which, if any, funding elements should remain outside of the base funds, and then study other issues that come before the task force that are relevant to this.
There's been debate about who should serve on the task force. Horn is open to adding school superintendents, financial officers, possibly county commissioners.
I certainly recognize that ultimately has to be our decision. We're talking about a lot of money and a lot of kids' lives, a lot of adult lives. This is a big deal. This is going to be a heavy lift. So any opportunity we can have to ensure the broadest possible participation without talking it to death, every opportunity needs to be pursued, in my view.
That's State Representative Craig Horn. He's discussing a proposal for a new North Carolina legislative task force. It would study the state's school funding system and make recommendations for changing funding formulas in the future. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of the largest obstacles to free speech on college campuses in recent years involves so-called speech codes. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, recently released its latest spotlight on speech codes. It helps people determine which campuses are doing a good job and which ones are falling short of the mark when it comes to limits on free speech. Robert Shibley is executive director of the FIRE. He joins us now to discuss the report. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into some of the details, remind us, what is a speech code?
FIRE defines a speech code as a policy, and it can be any kind of policy that regulates the expression of college or university students. They're often found in harassment codes, but they can also be found in codes about how to express yourself on the internet or over email, in residence life manuals about what you're allowed to do and say in the dormitories. And we classify them using a red, yellow, and green light system, with red light speech codes being laughably unconstitutional at public universities and extremely against the promises of free speech that are made by private universities. Yellow light codes are ones that can too easily be abused and are still unconstitutional. And green light schools, we would say they don't have speech codes anymore. Green light schools are ones that have no policies that could reasonably be used or abused to punish speech. Now, that doesn't mean that green light schools are going to be perfect. They may punish people for speech without having those policies, but at least they're not on the books.
How common are these speech codes? Is this something that we see on many campuses across the country?
Oh, they're hugely common. I think if you add the red and yellow light schools together, it comes to a little more than 90% of all schools in the universe, all the schools we rate, which is most of the big ones. We rate about, I think it's 440 plus of the largest and most prestigious schools, our colleges and universities in the country. So that covers most of the students out there.
Your report, though, takes a look from year to year at changes in those red, yellow, and green light schools. What did the 2017 report tell you in terms of changes?
Well, you know, the headline takeaway from this year's report is that we're finally really making some serious headway against the very worst speech codes, red light speech codes. When we started doing this report back in, I believe it was 2006, might have been 2007, we found that 78 or 79% of colleges and universities, both public and private, had red light speech codes. As of this year, that's down to around 40%. Last year, it was 50%. 49.9. So it's down 10% in a year, by far the fastest fall in a year. And, you know, that's due to several factors, a lot of it fires work, and also due to the House Judiciary Chairman Bob Goodlatte from Georgia, who wrote a letter to the red light schools saying, you know, it's time to fix your policies. And many of them did contact us to work on that.
So it really is thanks to a concerted effort that these schools have seen, okay, there's a problem. We need to do something about it.
That's right. And FIRE has also for the last 4 years engaged in a focused litigation program to sue really the worst offenders here and start to move the incentives towards actually respecting free speech. You know, before that, you know, given the incentives out there and then the political leanings of everyone involved, frankly, it made more sense on a rational level, if you take, you know, just principle out of it, to have these speech codes and to say, oh, well, this person said something bad. We're going to punish them. So we wanted to reorder the incentives so that the Constitution actually gets a little notice when they're making those decisions.
We are speaking with Robert Shibley, who is Executive Director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. We talked about sort of the national trends. How are schools in North Carolina doing?
Well, North Carolina schools are quite a bit better than average. I believe we're down to four red light schools in North Carolina. And when I say – I know I've been saying schools a lot, I'm talking about higher education, which is FIRE's area. Most of the rest are yellow, and North Carolina does pretty well with green light schools, including UNC Chapel Hill and Duke are both green light schools. And that's due to, again, a concerted effort, I think, by organizations here in North Carolina like the Pope Center, now the Martin Center, like John Locke, and of course, you know, FIRE, and I live in North Carolina as well, and so, you know, it's definitely been a goal of mine to see my home state, you know, improve on that.
So we've seen improvement in terms of speech codes. Does that also translate into improvement overall in the protection of free speech on campuses, or are there other threats that we really ought to be watching out for as well?
Well, it definitely has led to a decrease in people being punished for speech alone. There have really been improvements there, and UNC is actually a great example. When I started at FIRE about 13 years ago, it seemed like a year wouldn't go by when we didn't have a problem at UNC Chapel Hill. And since then, I mean, since they went green, I don't know that we've had any. However, there are sort of societal factors that are causing problems. Students now are more ready than ever to demand that the authorities on campus, which are usually deans and other administrators, censor their opponents. We see speakers being shouted down or prevented from speaking, as we saw last week at UC Davis. And of course, the disinvitations of graduation speakers. So unfortunately, while students really used to be the most reliable boosters of free speech on campus, it's hard to know whether that's still true.
So it sounds as if the speech code campaign in and of itself has been pretty successful. Is FIRE looking at now sort of the next steps? Speech codes, we still want to attack them, but now we have to focus on some other things too to make sure that free speech is preserved?
We are. I mean, as sort of enormous an effort as that was, I think we now have a bigger task ahead of us in dealing with a culture that no longer puts as much value on free speech on college campuses. And we actually have a two-year program funded by the John Templeton Foundation that we're calling Project SOAR. Doesn't really matter what that stands for, but we are actually going to be researching we're going into high schools and going to figure out what is going on there. Why are students who are coming into college now so, I guess, accepting of this idea that, you know, they can get there and people are going to tell them what they can say or think. That seems to be a change to us. And so we want to try to figure out what's going on and also start to address that as well.
Why is this such a big deal? Why do we need to pay attention to protecting free speech?
Well, this stuff doesn't stay on campus. I think a great example is the sort of thing we see in Europe, where increasingly there are crackdowns on free speech in a variety of different ways. Europeans have a very different idea, and that's because of years and decades, frankly, of having this different attitude. So, you know, when students have this attitude on campus, they're going to take it with them off campus, and we will start to lose that fundamental American freedom if we're not careful about it. The law is right now very much on the side of free speech, but that won't stay if all the future judges and attorneys don't think it's a good idea.
Do you, in looking at the state of affairs right now, have some optimism about where things are heading, or is it a sort of a dicey situation now?
It's a dicey situation about which I think I'm ultimately optimistic, because the direction I think culturally was wrong. I think there's more recognition now that maybe this wasn't a sustainable direction to go in, and I think the success of folks who've pushed policies that would compromise free speech. You know, when you get to the point where you're, you know, talking about actually punishing people for things like microaggressions, which are totally unintentional, insults or could be perceived as insults, I think a lot of people get the sense that this has probably gone too far and they're willing to say, you know, let's back off a bit.
Well, one person who's going to be watching this situation very closely in the months and years ahead is Robert Shibley. He is executive director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina is seeing success with a proven tool for fighting red tape. That's thanks to a rules review process that was put into place several years ago here in our state. John Sanders has been looking at the program, which, by the way, is set to perhaps get even stronger in battling the thousands of rules and regulations that slow economic growth. John, of course, the Director of Regulatory Studies at the John Locke Foundation, and he joins us now. Welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
First of all, John, when we talk about rules and regulations, we use that phrase a lot. I know, and that is your beat, so to speak. You write about it. Give us some examples of rules and regulations that North Carolina would impose on citizens.
Well, it could be anything regarding how you deal with your property, how you deal with your employees, if you're an employer. It incorporates so many aspects of our lives and so many things that we do as small business, what reporting requirements we have to make with the state government, things like that.
So pretty much any industry has some sort of rules and regulations attached to it. So in our state, we could be talking about anything from automotive industries mm-hmm. to the farming, agriculture and agribusiness area to retail business operations. So it's pretty much everything.
Yes, and there's so many. I mean, you mentioned thousands. There's over 20,000 rules. It's finding an actual count is actually difficult. There's no way that any one person could keep all of that straight.
And we should remind folks that we're talking about the rules that are just coming from the state of North Carolina. That doesn't involve anything from the feds or any local governments or anything like that.
Yeah, no, we're talking about state of North Carolina administrative rules.
Okay, so we have been hearing for a long time, because we've been reading you and talking to you, that we need to take a really close look at a lot of these rules and regulations. Could be that some of them are appropriate and necessary, but it could be that there's stuff on the books that really don't need to be there. And several years ago, we actually started into that process. Give us a kind of a review of what's been happening.
Yes. In 2013, the General Assembly passed and the Governor McCrory at the time signed the Sunset with Periodic Review as part of the Regulatory Reform Act of 2013. What that does is every 10 years, an agency rule has to be reviewed. And so that's the periodic review portion. And if it is not, then it automatically sunsets, which means it's repealed. And under review, the agency can say that it's necessary, and if no one objects, if they don't collect a certain number of public comments on it that are on point, then it's considered necessary without substantive public input, which means it automatically starts the clock right back over for another 10 years. If they get enough people to object, then it's considered necessary with substantive public input, and then it has to be re-looked over and treated as if it's a brand new rule and go through the rules review process again as if it's brand new. And otherwise, if it's declared unnecessary, then it's going to be repealed.
You are talking about three different categories,
yes.
And I think we commonly, or you've been referring to them and other folks have as well, as like the three buckets of rules. Okay, so as of the end of 2016 and early 2017, give us a sense of where we stand in the review process, and has anything actually been wiped away?
So the last numbers that I've seen at the end of December, not quite half of the rules have been looked at so far, and about 12% or approximately one out of every eight have been repealed, have been declared unnecessary, and they're going to end. The great proportion of them are sort of the middle bucket, the necessary without substantive public input. With input. So they are going to automatically start over. And then the remainder are going to be re-looked at as if brand new.
So it sounds as if we've got some that were looked at, and the folks who did this said, you know what, there's no reason we need this, so let's just get rid of them. That's that one out of eight.
Right.
And then there's a big chunk of them that they've looked at and said, well, we don't have a bunch of objections or anything like that, so we're going to start that clock over. They get to go for another 10 years. But, John, then there's that other bucket where they're going to get a little bit more intense scrutiny. Tell us about that bucket.
Yeah, the one where they're going to get more intense scrutiny, that's not a problem. I misspoke a second ago because I didn't use the term bucket, and so I got tripped up. The necessary without substantive public input is the middle bucket, and that's where like almost 62% of the rules have fallen under. And that means they're just going to start right back over.
Mm-hmm.
The state rules review chairman testified before the General Assembly and suggested we really need to get rid of that category because we really need to look over all of the rules and not have sort of an easy out. Every 10 years, we really should reexamine all the rules and make that a stronger reform. And I do agree with that because it's so easy for these things to get lost. It's sort of like having a messy tool shed is the way I look at it. You can throw some stuff in there, and after a while, it get covered with dust. You forget what you got back in there. You could drag everything out and take a look at it again and decide if you actually still need them.
And if you're like my husband and me, that only happens if you happen to move and you are forced to actually clean everything out. And then you take a look at some of that stuff and say, yeah, I want to keep it. But other stuff, you may not even remember it's there.
Yes.
And in fact, that's sort of the situation that occurred when the person in charge of this program was talking about it to legislators. There have actually been instances, John, am I right, where the folks who were asked to review rules didn't even realize they were there. And no disrespect to them, but it's just this process you've been talking about.
Absolutely. That's some of the testimony that came out from the Rules Review Chairman was that, you know, in the course of doing this, they didn't realize those things were on the books. So it was a necessary thing for them to actually go through.
What was the reaction from the legislators who were hearing from this person who's in charge of the program? Were they interested in this or did they think, oh, this is kind of much ado about nothing here?
I think there is some interest in it. There's a bill in the Senate that's looking at that right now. I'm not sure where it is in the process at the moment, but it seemed like it had generated some interest.
So at least there are some legislators who think that this is important enough that we should pay attention to it and perhaps strengthen this and have a little bit more intense scrutiny on
yes.
more of these rules going forward. But already, as you said, one out of eight has ended up being wiped from the books. Now, John, when you were writing about this, giving us an update on this this look at the rules, you also made some other recommendations about how we could improve things going forward. I'd like to talk a little bit about those. You talked about more of a focus on the costliest rules. Tell us about that.
The costliest rules are ones that are still passed by administrative agencies. It's my contention that legislators who are answerable to the voting public should be the ones making those deeply impactful rules, laws.
We've been talking with John Sanders with the John Locke Foundation. John, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program. Thank you for listening. Hope you'll join Mitch Kokai and me again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org. Or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.